I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, you're listening to The BIP Show. I'm Paul Colgan, director at CT Group. I'm here as always with James Whelan of VFS Group.
How are you now, Paul?
Good, mate. Joining us from Amsterdam is Ken Vexler, Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer at Acumen Management. How are you, Ken?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, Colga. I'm well. Sun's out, snow's melted, and we can actually traverse the streets. So we're on our way.
Good stuff. We have got a real treat for you this week, listeners. We talked all about the GameStop insanity on the last show, all that nonsense. But over the next couple of shows, we are taking a deep breath, going back to the question of what's happening to the global economy. After the truly remarkable year we've just been through, we are delighted to be joined for this conversation by a globally renowned strategist and economist. Kit Jukes joined Societe Generale as global head of FX strategy in 2010 before taking an additional role covering fixed income, credit and currency strategy before SocGen. Kit was chief economist at the ECU Group, a London-based currency management firm. And before that, he was global head of research at RBS. Kit has been around. He was just telling us that he bought some Nikkei in 1989. Yeah. Kit's insights and perspectives are sought the world over by investors and global corporates. So we are delighted to have him on the show. Kit Jukes, welcome to the BIP Show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
I know Ken is champing at the bit to get in here. So, Ken, dive in.
Shall do. Kit, g'day, mate. It's been a long, old while. And last time we caught up, I think it was the tail end of 19, and it involved pints when I was back in London, sadly. Not on this occasion, but hopefully soon one day again. And I echo Paul's sentiment in thanking you for being on the show today. But I suppose getting into it, as Colgo mentioned, let's take a deep breath. And what I want to start off with you initially is just to get a sense from you what your perception is of where we are today in market terms. So basically, in your mind, whereabouts in the cycle are we? You know, and how, more to the point, does this translate across asset classes?
It's obviously self-evident. It's a very odd cycle, but I think we've been forced, probably in all assets, to make it a shorter cycle in markets because we're having to look further into the future. If that doesn't sound stupid, so you know. Everything changed on the 23rd of March last year when the Fed kind of completed its week of policy moves, fixing the cross-currency swap market in foreign exchange, fixing Treasury repo, making it broadly accessible, fixing monetary easing, fixing their lending program to companies, and really just changing the mood in financial markets in a way that's so much bigger than anything they've done before. It was much more aggressive than after the financial crisis and much more timely than during the Asian crisis, if I go back that far. That to my mind, we like to think in calendar years, but that was a massive change for markets. From that moment on, we're effectively saying financial markets can price in an economic recovery, but they can price it in with the with the certainty that the Fed's going to be so far behind the curve on tightening that we don't even have to think about it. Then when vaccines started to emerge and we got the second round of really major optimism through the autumn, and inevitably I think that once we've done that, it means that we're pricing in an economic recovery, which for some people isn't going to happen until next year, possibly. But we've been doing it for 6 months quite merrily. And I think it's the right thing for markets to do. We hardly care about kind of today's economic data. We hardly really care about today's policy rates because we're looking further out. And we're moving through markets looking at who is going to outperform now, but mostly it's pretty one-dimensional. Rates are really low. There's a big economic recovery coming. It's pretty V-shaped by the nature of it, and it's going to get to everybody in the end. By the time we get that recovery, markets, I think, will have eaten up all of the joy that can come from it, and we'll have to move to the next thing. So we should enjoy it while it lasts, but it's this year's story, surely.
Will the markets eat up that joy before the recovery comes, do you think? Or is it sort of, simultaneously? Because I personally think that that joy is going to get devoured fairly quickly. Like, the appetite is unending. And, what do you think?
Look, I think it's this year's business, not next year's business. I think next year, next year is a completely different story. So if my day job is forecasting foreign exchange rates, I think the low for the US dollar is a 2021 story, not a 2022 story.
Sure. And I mean, and it's what you mentioned in answering that, I suppose, regarding the fact that markets are now looking, not even in calendar year terms, but sort of looking at beyond that, looking through and discounting data. And I mean, the market's been discounting data since probably midway through last year, when it realized that it just simply doesn't matter. But to that end, I suppose that drives my next question to you, which is, as far as I'm concerned, and it's ironic to me, but the market has proven itself over the course of, say, the last 9 or even 12 months to be incredibly efficient as a discounting mechanism. I mean, that's not to say it hasn't been violent and incredibly quick, but exactly as you mentioned, we discounted the fact that Fed's got it back, vaccines on its way, roaring 20s, which we'll cover, thematically later in the show. But all of these things, it's all good news, and we can discount everything and efficiently, look at where we are. So I suppose, and also, as you mentioned, rates are, clearly they're staying low for God knows how long. And the fact that we're seeing some marginal steepening somewhere in the curve, that's the back end, and does it really matter? But my question is, how does that environment, to your mind, affect the investment and or speculative trends that we're likely to see over, let's not get too ahead of ourselves, over, say, the next 6 to 12 months?
I think the battle now in terms of the important market, I mean, the most important market today, I suspect, is the bond market again, sort of more than anything else, because that's where the tension is between market and Fed. That's where the tension is between good inflation, bad inflation. That's where fiscal policy plays itself out, if it does. I've always believed that the number of bonds you sell doesn't really affect yields, only in a minor way. It might affect spreads if you have to crowd investment out of corporate bonds into government bonds in one country. It can have other effects, but the bond market tells you, broadly speaking, where people think yields will be in a really long time, depending on how far down the curve you go. And that battle that we now have, as people scramble to get protection against possible inflation, when the Fed is saying it's going to tolerate more of it, is going to drive things, because equity strategists are going to run around working out at what level of bond yields do my sums on equity valuation no longer work. And in the foreign exchange market, we'll try to work out whether, we believe that we're going to get a weak dollar because the Fed's on hold for a really long time, or a strong dollar because yield differentials are moving in favor of the U.S. And so how far bond yields go, and how fast, perhaps more than anything else, how fast bond yields go, is probably going to determine everything. Now, I lean to a view in that sense over the next 6 to 9 months that the Fed, with a clear plan to make sure that we embed a global economic recovery, is ultimately doesn't want to, wants to let the bond market go wherever it goes when yields are still this low, but isn't going to let this get out of control. And that in the near term, inflationary pressures aren't nearly high enough for the bond market to get out of control properly, so that we'll end up with with the kind of the recent pace of yield rises being unsustainable, and that'll calm down and let us have risk assets perform in the next 6 to 9 months. But I notice myself check bond yields in bed in the morning again, which I haven't been doing for a few years.
Yeah, as have I, admittedly, this morning. And that sort of, I'm just wondering, is it dog wagging tail or tail wagging dog, in that, you know, the narrative in the last, I don't know, 36 hours is that, well, the 30 basis points that we've seen in the 10-year is horrific. It's curtailed the recent all-time high rally in spoos and risk assets. And my God, if this goes on, you know, we're facing an imminent crash. But to your point exactly, I mean, does the market at some point reconcile that, well, hang on, if we really drive yields too far too quick, we're cutting our nose off to spite our face? Because, I mean, you know, plenty of people are invested in the equity space. Yields go up too quickly, you're not going to force the Fed's hand this year. That they've made clear. So they're not going to intimate raising rates. But you are going to potentially hurt your wallet in the equity free fall that could ensue, even if it's for, say, 10% and it's brief. So I suppose there's that mix. I mean, what to your mind, if we take the 10-year, right, what to your mind is the critical level and how quickly we get this? I mean, if we get there over a space of 2 weeks, that's pretty dire. But what's the level?
I think that's the piece. Right? To me, for the sake of argument, if we went to 1.5% right now, that might be just about bearable, but that would be a stretch. But we could get to 2% by Christmas without anything going really badly wrong.
Sure.
So I do think the time. Now, look, I mean, I'd take it one step further than that and say, you flip it around and say, this is, in a sense, what we've created that's dangerous, is that if markets need you know, yields to be under 3% for the foreseeable future, if that's where we are, looking back at where the peak was in rates in the last cycle and the one before, then how do you reach an equilibrium between asset prices and the real economy if you sit there and think, well, you know, over most of my life, actually probably over exactly my life, nominal yields have averaged roughly the same as nominal GDP growth, and that kind of made sense to me. But if now them getting anywhere near nominal growth is catastrophic, you know, maybe that. So we have short-term equilibria with low yields, but at some point we're going to have to get back to a longer-term equilibrium for the global economy and global markets. Otherwise, we're going to have asset prices that create bubbles or overshoots and need to come back, bringing recessions with them until we do. And so, you know, we're not solving the long-term problem at the moment. We're just dealing with a nasty virus. But you would want, in that sense, the Fed probably, you know, knows enough to think, I'd like these things to edge up in a controlled fashion, because staying too low for too long just isn't healthy in terms of what it does.
Yeah, and I suppose that's a central bank issue that we can cover off at some point. But I mean, we're talking about, you know, the great toilet flush that never happened in 08 as much as it was needed. The great financial reckoning that I probably think will not be in my professional lifetime. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, this is what happens when money is free, and even at 2% or whatever else, you know, if you're using that risk-free rate to discount valuations, well what are you going to do? I think James wanted to jump in just quickly. Is that right, mate?
Yeah, Kit, mate, thanks for coming on, and it's really good to talk to you. Mate, you've said a lot of stuff, and I've written down a lot of notes, and thank you, Ken, for giving me an edge in here, mate. Look, I'll go with the last thing you said. So you said that markets need a certain yield percentage to survive, to keep on going. I'm a thematic guy, and wouldn't it just be certain markets potentially that need a certain yield to survive, or is it all markets, do you think? Like, is now the time, and look, 2020 was the year of, in March, just buy everything and just go nuts because everything's just going up, because this is the asset bubble, this is the everything bubble. But is 2021, and this is what people are saying, is the time to be picking themes and be very specific about it as potentially the rotation kicks on? So what yields do certain markets need?
I guess different markets need different yields, and there is a common sort of piece. If you look, you know, we live in Anglo-Saxon countries where our housing markets are expensive because our rates are low, and perhaps Australia's also, because it's a really cool place with lots of with a growing number of people. But hey, the central principle, you know, we're going to find a world this year in Anglo-Saxon economies in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, where house prices are going to get supported by keeping rates down. And so some of those, some you know, and some that, you know, in the Anglo-Saxon economies that are driven by that, it's the whole economy that's overly geared to it. Now, there are different assets. There are different assets and certainly different bits of for example, the equity market that are less sensitive. Some like steep curves, like the financial sector, and that, that helps them make money. And some don't care very much because that they're not dependent on money to finance their business. I'm not sure, you know, the tech sector, you know, is a different thing from everything else because these are cash rich people. They don't need to worry about that. So yeah, I think it makes a big difference. But I'd sort of come back and say at the moment when we're coming when we've saved the day for markets with just truly extraordinary monetary policy. How we normalize that policy, you know, is going to make a difference to pretty much everything. But, you know, I do in that sense overall, look, I think, you know, if you have a controlled rise in U.S. yields, then maybe that still means people want to be underweight government bonds, but it gives credit spreads a chance to tighten further in the current environment. And particularly if you limit government bond moves and you keep the dollar soft, it gives a chance for money to start flowing in earnest towards emerging markets at some point, which really does make a difference to things.
Can I ask you about in that context the outlook for business investment? I saw a chart last week showing CapEx as a percentage of Australian GDP. And it is as low now as it was around the early 90s recession here at about 10.5-11% of GDP. During the mining boom, it was, you know, up around 15 plus or more. But where do you think, like with rates where they are, and in our experience, certainly in Australia, I'm not sure what it's like in Europe, but hurdle rates for investments by companies staying relatively high and not coming down along with, say, for example, the US 10-year. What do you think about the outlook for business investment and the types of areas that we might see strong capital expenditure or the lack of it?
I think you're going to have to get, I mean, so, you know, first up, in this environment of really cheap money, we've seen far too many companies who are far too happy to buy back shares to improve their share price rather than, you know, making investments to improve what they do, if that's too simplistic. And that environment has given us, you know, serious doubts about what happens to trend growth over the course of the next 10, 15 years. So, you know, the big story out there is to some degree, this you know, excessively easy monetary policy is having damaging long-term side effects. So can we do this temporarily? I think the big unknown is how we manage a lot of the fiscal spend in various places in terms of how it feeds through into potential growth and into investment. Because the biggest investor in most economies in the next couple of years is going to be governments with what they're doing. And if what they're doing is try to move to more environmentally friendly economies, for example, if they're going to make investments that do that, then we'll get a lot of investment. Now, what it does to the way we calculate GDP, if it gives us cleaner air, is going to be another thing for us to worry about. But that's where the investment needs to come. They need to lead and to fuel investment. The current state of play, I mean, you're right. If the hurdle rate for investment is high and the return of buying back your shares as a company is attractive.
I know what I'd take.
We're not in a good place.
No, and it's too easy to do. Ken, back over to you.
Thank you, guys. That sort of, well, it, in one way or another, ties back to where I wanted to take the next, the next question, let's say. Tail end of last year, so sort of, you know, mid-late December, all the annual outlooks for 21 were being published by the sell side, and generally on the fact that there was a vaccine available or a couple of vaccines available, etc., etc. Thematically, every man and his dog was talking about the Roaring Twenties Redux. Yeah, Goldman Sachs came out with a note, and everyone sort of jumped onto the back of it. And I suppose it makes sense to me, you know, at a you know, helicopter level, the idea of it. You know, the reflation trade, everything's going to be great. Things are reopening. People are going to be out there spending this, that, and the other. Without getting into the weeds, and there's a follow-up to this, I suppose my question to you, Kit, is, you know, do you subscribe to the idea? Yes or no?
Roaring Twenties, yeah, but the weeds are bigger than the story. But Z-shaped global economic recovery in the first instance, yes. Because once we unlock, you know, look, we're going down the pub. I mean, that's just what's going to happen.
Yeah. Okay, so with that in mind, I suppose, you know, that goes into the whole reflation trade and what we spoke about earlier in terms of markets being able to discount very quickly, if not violently. In the last few days, seemingly out of nowhere, but I suppose it follows on from, it's the natural progression of, well, if there's a reflation trade and a paradigm in the world, then, you know, this talk of the great commodity bull super cycle has just, you know, sprouted within the last, as I said, 72 hours or thereabouts. I mean, it's probably a bit longer in the making, but there's a lot of noise about it, you know, coming out. And to me, my two cents worth is that it's a function of, yeah, natural conclusion of the reflation trade, markets discounting for the here and now. But, you know, I don't think it's set to last. I don't think this is the next bull run super cycle in commodities because, frankly, well, that's just not my view. So is it a case of the market discounting very quickly, or is this time genuinely, you know, as they say, different? What do you think?
No, look, I think one of the things I get when I talk to our commodity analysts is that they'll come back sort of relatively repeatedly and say, you've got to be careful because there's lots of different stories for why we've had commodity prices higher in the short run. So, you know, the things that have driven a lot of the agricultural prices up in recent months have nothing to do with the global commodity super cycle stuff. You know, the driver of copper is not the same as the driver of some of the other things. So, you know, there are things that if we're all going to drive electric cars, that there are some commodities that are going to do really well. But that's not the same as a global commodity cycle. And so I do worry. I worry with the idea that you can talk about a global cycle when the first thing I look at and talk about in my mind is, you know, that the nature of this particular recession, which was unique, was that if you open up the doors and let everybody go out, you get back a lot of the, you know, a lot of the pent up spending gets spent really quickly, frankly, and that gives you a great sugar rush. But I'm not sure I build super cycles off sugar rushes.
Yeah, so and I know James is going to jump in here, and I'll let him do that. But that actually, I want to touch once James has mentioned what he wants to have a chat about. Exactly that. Like, I think you and I subscribe to the exact same thing, and it's the great inflation debate which feeds into it. You know, is it transitory or real? But we'll get back to that. James, I know you're chomping at the bit.
Kit. Look, okay. So summarize that one. That you've got. Okay, I'm a big food guy, so I've been long food for a while, and then just recently, or actually, a while ago, I was long commodities, and then timed it. You know, I've retimed it to be long commodities again. Everything except gold. For some reason, gold. We won't do gold this episode because that's a whole episode, and then we're going to get a lot of feedback. But food.
That's like a bad episode.
Yeah, that's a good. It's going to be a good episode. Don't worry about that. And then wait until we do crypto. Paul, that's a whole different thing. But so, Kit, look, let's stay focused. So, the commodity super cycle. So, what's running on this one is that it's not one big, in my view, it's not one big sort of theme. It's not one big trend. It is actually the way that you've laid it out. It's there is a food shortage. There is actually, you know, the shipping shortage. There is actually a shipping price increase. There's actually that food physically. Getting food from one place to another that potentially it has a virus on it. That was the key that food is more expensive to get it to. It goes back to the German health minister saying that meat is too cheap, that the meat factories are actually sort of being run crazy cheap, that you actually need to put proper workers in and proper healthcare facilities in and actually put separation in. But then you've also got the other thing with the fact that you've got EV. You know, an EV car compared to an internal combustion engine takes three times as much copper. there's physically, and I've heard this, and I've yet to see it proven, but the people who I trust to know these things tell me that there's literally not enough lithium on the planet, in the planet, to be able to sit in the batteries that we need to run all of these cars that we were actually going to have. Maybe with all of this spending, we're actually on, you know, we are actually on the precipice of this, like a super cycle, that it's not a continual, it's not, go back to what, 2005, 2006, 2007, and I remember these days when I was coming in of China. It was just, the super cycle was easy. It was China. China's just buying everything. Everything's going to be fine because China is buying everything, because look at these guys, they're growing. They've got 9.5% GDP growth. Everything is fantastic. Now, potentially, we've got the super cycle that is just a whole bunch of different areas, like you just laid out, that are all coordinating in being very, very bullish for the potentially the next 3, 4, 5 years.
And I think that they have, I mean, they have different stories. So if I take, certainly, you know, a lot of food is unlike copper. I mean, copper to grain is an easy comparison, where you can ramp up output of grain really quickly, but you can't do it in three. You can do it over a growing season. In other words, if there's a shortage of grain, I can't do anything to get more grain out in this harvest, yep, but I can plant more for next harvest, and my plans are affected by it. So you get short-term spikes in that are pretty important. That's completely different from copper or lithium, where, you know, for a really long time, the amount of investment to get global copper supplies up is pretty monumental. And lithium will no doubt be the same, although apparently the biggest lump of lithium in Europe is on Dartmoor. So, I'm, you know, maybe my house in Devon's going to be worth more than my house in London one of these days, even if it's going to be scary. But so I think they're different stories. So... And I'm cautious enough to think that some of them are going to have longer legs than others of them overall. And that you're right. You know, that, you know, our past experience is when you get a great lurch forwards in global demand, then commodities all go up together. We are not getting a great lurch forward in global demand. We're seeing a big fall in demand that's rapidly replaced, and then we go back as we were with, you know, an aging Chinese economy and all the things that we're used to. So I think it's different. And that's not to knock the idea that, you know, saying it's different doesn't mean commodity prices won't go higher, but it's certainly not the same super cycle as the last one.
And one of the big kickers for a commodities bull market, or the easy bull case for a commodities bull market, is a weakening US dollar. And that's a big part of the investment thesis behind it, of doing that. So if we want to talk about relative yields, so sort of lay out the case that you've got there with the fact that if all yields are moving in an upwards direction across the, you know, across the euro, across the US, across Australia, then that's okay. Then that's not a bearish case for the US dollar. What's the bearish case for the US dollar?
I think, in a sense, there's two parts to a bearish case for US dollar. The first one is that, you know, foreign exchange markets were trundling along, if you like, until 2015, when the ECB, bothered by how expensive the euro was, dramatically changed monetary policy. I guess 2 years after the Japanese dramatically changed monetary policy, drove rates to zero, real rates into significantly negative territory, and got their currencies to fall very sharply. The US has spent the next few years with a really increasingly expensive currency because they're the odd man out that hasn't done that. Last March to August was Jay Powell's Draghi moment, if you want, or Jay Powell's Abenomics moment, if you want, in terms of BOJ policy. And we're trying to get currencies back to roughly where they were before any of us did that, where the US economy is still better than the Japanese economy or the European economy, but interest rate differentials are just completely different from what they've been for the last few years. Now, we're resetting to that at the moment, and I don't think we're necessarily done. That'll be done this year, though. You know, it's not a new long-term, if you like, dollar bear cycle, because the U.S. economy is going to outgrow Europe and Japan in the next 10 years in all likelihood, because the bond market's telling you, really, that when we settle down, we'll get to higher rates in the U.S. But in the short run, while they've got really low short-term rates, really low real rates, and a really big fiscal deficit that's going to drag their current account deficit into different territory, I think this undermines it. And on the positive side of it, we get to exactly the right place of a global smile, where frankly, the returns of returns to money from leaving the United States or Europe are going to be attractive. The rest of the world is just a better place to put money. I would put money in Australia or New Zealand before putting it in the United States at this point, at these rates, for sure. And so I think that's the case for the 2021 dollar fall, which I don't think is over. 2022, 2023 is much harder. If the Fed then finds that this boost to U.S. growth does lead to outperformance over the next 5 years in growth terms, then the Fed will be normalized next, possibly earlier than they want to. It's talking about normalizing through 2022 at some point. And then I think we're done. The dollar cycle's going back the other way. So in that sense, and again, I'll go back to the commodity cycle. The good bits of it will all happen this year.
Just while we're on the notion of the dollar, how do you see? I mean, it's not going to be a smooth. Okay, the dollar's got room still to weaken this year, and probably by the end of this year it's done, and next year and thereabouts it looks to consolidate and pick up. But what kit do you say to the fact that, I mean, throughout this, or what's left of this year, it's not. I don't think it's going to be a smooth. The dollar just keeps declining, be it a little bit quicker, a little bit slow. I think we've seen already in the last probably few weeks or month thereabouts, just this notion of, there are days and weeks where the dollar decouples and then recouples with an overall risk sentiment. So, I mean, it has almost mini dollar smiles within the space of a week or 10 days. And then it goes back to the broader arching theme of a weaker dollar for all the reasons you described. I mean, is that something that you think is temporary, or do you think that's how this overall dollar weakening this year is going to play out continually?
Yeah, look, I think if you said that the dollar's fall started, it started on the 24th of March, when we woke up in the morning, we didn't realize it fast enough collectively. Yeah. That by the time we get to this year, as is the way in the foreign exchange market, a lot's priced in. So if we took euro dollar from 108 to 122, that's the meat. 130 might be reachable, somewhere between 125, 130 surely should be reachable in my mind. But that still means I've eaten three quarters of my meal now. I'm on coffee and biscuits at this point. And that bit's messier. I think that's fair. And again, a bond driven FX market is messy because when you've anchored the front end and the long end's wanging around, it puts choppiness rather than real volatility into it.
Well, that's it. I mean, FX looks to discount, the here and now within a nanosecond generally. I mean, that's always been a good thing about the FX market despite overshoots. But exactly that, if the front and even to some degree the belly is pinned, then you're discounting fresh air because how are you going to discount the back end? But following on with a weaker dollar, theme, how does this play out for EM? Is EM the big winner in the potential for commodities to run higher, irrespective of the rationale why commodity prices run higher, a weaker dollar, etc.?
The first part of the answer is not a useful one, which is I really, really, really hope so. And the second part is it's bound because it's a good thing. So if you kind of summarized it all, is that monetary policy drives developed market currencies far more than economic activity. Some people outside the FX market struggle with. But then in emerging markets, economic growth prospects drive everything, right? Because I don't just buy XYZ's bonds because they've got a higher yield. I buy Turkish bonds now because they've had a complete, total and utter sort of, at least for a few years, epiphany on how they run monetary policy in their country. So it's safe again. And then we go off like a train. But in places in Latin America where they haven't solved the pandemic, where they've got some difficult governments to cope with in terms of how they do things, then I think it's just you need the growth story to improve. Right. And for the last decade, the emerging market growth story, if we strip out what used to be called emerging Asia, sort of greater China, it's not been good enough. And that's what they need most of all. Now, maybe, a commodity cycle would change that for a while, right? But we you know, globally, the global economy needs, you know, to figure out how to help emerging market economies to grow. Really, that comes down to it. Then the other bit that we say about, I'll just throw it in there, is that when people talk about emerging markets, I mean, just an enormous amount of it's a function of what happens in China, because it's such a big weight, which is just a different story. And that's separate. And in foreign exchange terms, you'd have to turn around and say that, you know, when you look at the Chinese thing, you know, it's not a free floating currency in the way that others are. It's much more tightly controlled. They've let it get stronger than quite a lot of people thought already, but you wouldn't necessarily think they're going to let the yuan go on some super strength, because it's not obvious what they benefit from when their consumer prices are falling year over year.
Yeah, exactly. And just one last point, I don't want to get too heavily into this, but you mentioned, you know, the fact that, you know, the growth that we've seen in you know, Greater Asia or thereabouts, you know, recently just simply wasn't good enough. But I mean, is that predicated on the fact that people, it doesn't matter whether it's an EM or DM, frankly want to see growth that equaled, rivaled, or whatever, paralleled growth, global growth levels that we saw pre-2008, and the fact that that is a target that we're simply never going to reach. You know, aspirational, sure, but in, you know, we had 2010 was great, but certainly not pre, you know, like levels pre-2008. You know, is this just foolish expectations, the fact that we're just simply not going to get there?
Yeah, I mean, look, the North Asian economies are all similar enough in some regards, in the sense that, you know, they all have declining birth rates, they've all got aging populations, they all have savings cultures. How do you generate long-term sustainable growth as your economy gets bigger out of that, when you know, you're going to have to spend more and more of the domestic income, you know, looking after the older people in families, growing the labor force will get eventually progressively harder. It can't be the sort of flat out export driven model of the last 30 years. A potential growth rate actually for the whole block of North Asia, goes from a really high growth rate and then trends down. And I think there are people who are very worried about what that means for the sustainability of debt levels and so on as well further out. But the first thing you do is that this is going to go on slowing slowly over time. It's just baked in the cake.
Okay. So now, a bugbear of mine, or not even a bugbear, but something that certainly James and I have
bring it
tussled on and. Well, it's not even you and I. I mean, it's generally a fairly significant divide in markets as a whole, the world over. The great inflation debate, you know, and certainly, let's put it in more finite terms, the great inflation debate as a consequence of all the stimulus, fiscal and monetary, that we've seen inside the last 12 months. My question is it, and I don't debate the fact that we're going to get a kick. You know, there will be down the line, sooner rather than later, some kick to the inflation numbers. It doesn't matter whether they're nominal or real. But my whole thing is, and Kit, I want your input in this, is this going to be a transitory kick, or is it going to be a real kick that actually moves us on to a steady inflation path and everything that comes with it? What do you think?
We get some short term effects because we've messed up supply chains, and because, you know, you would expect some of that to happen. In the very short term, what we're seeing is that the way we design our consumer price index, with things like shelter in the United States being a third of the overall thing, is it might not come in terribly quickly, and that the slack will offset. But you'll get a lot of, you know, you'll get a big jump in holiday prices when we're allowed to have any in airfares when people want to get back on airplanes, and there aren't so many around anymore. You know, there's just a whole host of those kinds of effects that we're going to get through in one off.
Three scoops of ice cream theory.
Exactly, and that can adjust to it. Behind that, there's a longer term story. Which, frankly, the first part of this, we know that the great disinflation has come from, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union delivering workers into Europe and the opening of China delivering workers into the whole world. At the same time as technology changed everything, and that this has given us massive disinflation in a time when central bankers have declared success in fighting inflation. And you look at it and think, not sure it was you really, I mean something else was going on, that those are ending over the course of the next, let's call it 10 to 20 years sufficiently, that we may well get some inflation back into the system. But the real piece about it is we don't easily understand long-term inflation. And so when people turn around and say, yeah, you know, we know how to fight inflation, I'm like, guys, but we've been really successful when a bunch of things came out of out of the sky and helped us. Watch out with the cockiness. And at the same time, when it comes back to this piece, is are we going to be willing to fight inflation when it means putting interest rates at levels that asset prices aren't prepared for? And how hard are we going to fight?
Yeah, and isn't that the greatest irony of all? You know, we're talking about fighting inflation where it can't be, it hasn't been cited for love nor money in God knows how long, and yet we're talking about, God forbid, things should overheat. And look, the last point on that, and I suppose this is something that I've inferred from the various notes of yours that I've read recently. Geographically, I think you're, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think you're sort of bullish on places like Australia, as you've mentioned, and to a degree Canada and or New Zealand. But I get the sense that bullishness, you know, on a relative scale, is based more so on the fact that you perceive that those countries are more likely to raise rates first or more quickly than other counterparts, be it the US, be it Europe, whoever it may be. I mean, is that it, or is there more to it, or have I got it completely wrong?
No, I think it's a big part of it. Look, I think, you know, that it's one thing for Jay Powell to say we can keep rates low until, you know, through 2023. I don't know if, if across the sea in New Zealand, I'm not sure that they've got enough macroprudential policies in the housing market to have that luxury, frankly. Economies that are so interest rate sensitive already are going to be harder to control in parts of the world where the fight against the virus has been more successful all along. So if I look at Asia, so with the currency hat on, I think that's fairly straightforward. I also think some countries have had, you know, a bigger win in terms of how they've tackled this. Some countries are going to benefit more from the commodity strength we've already seen. But yeah, look, you know, this is a world where nobody wants a strong currency, and the people who can't afford to keep their rates down low enough to have a strong currency, to have a weak currency, are going to be the losers who get strong ones. Almost as simple as that.
Do you remember a couple of years ago, Kit, when and Ken and Paul and everyone, when there was a currency war that was going on, and I reading your notes, Kit, that was there, that I've seen sort of mentioned that there potentially could be, you know, currency war sort of coming back on. Now, that's not the question that I want to ask, but that is something probably we're going to raise on our Facebook page, provided Facebook actually allows us to say things, but we'll go into that later. Now, sticking with the inflation side of things, so what I like to do with my guys is to lay out it doesn't matter what you think, it matters about what actually is the circumstance and then what you do. Let's talk about inflation back again. So let's look at the Bank of America. Like, I love the fund manager survey, and everyone does love the fund manager survey. The fund manager survey came out yesterday, and I always look at the inflation numbers. 86% of fund manager survey investors expect higher inflation in the next 12 months, which is down only 6% month on month. Now last month that was the highest of all times. What if it's not transitory? What if, okay, so Kit, Lay it out for us. Show me the path here where this is potentially the greatest reopening since the end of World War II. And that's an expression that I've used. And I know...
The Great Gatsby Redux.
It is. It's Gatsby, right? It's the 20s. There's always a bubble in the 20s. Show me what happens. Like, show me the investment case. What do you invest in if that actually is the case? Because I'm standing here just like, that's the case that I've got. I've been right so far. What's the 2021? Okay, it's the greatest reopening. You've got two. I've seen CNBC versus Morgan Stanley are both saying different numbers of how much money the US consumer has. Let's just say it's $2 trillion of excess spending. Kit, go.
Then I'll go back to, if it's back to the 20s. You know, the biggest difference about the Gatsby in the 20s, and when people talk about, you know, how they use it, is that it wasn't everybody. It was really limited to people who had fun. You know, the people who partied all the way through the 20s were not the same people as the ones that were going broke in Germany in hyperinflation. So the answer is, if there, you know, the enormous amount of pent-up spending that there is in the world is concentrated in the hands of a dispiritingly small number of people. And if you want to really enjoy that party, go and give them the things that they want to spend their money on. And maybe of all the most beaten up things, I don't know, maybe I should buy a cruise company. I mean, I can't imagine ever wanting to go on a cruise liner in my life, but maybe this is what all old people with spare cash are going to go and do. Go and look at whales up in Alaska or something. But it's spending on things that rich people spend on. It would be my guess.
So on inflation then, Kit, Paul Colgan here. Do you think, this is from one of our esteemed listeners, I won't say who, but he's a senior strategist here in Australia. He was curious to get your view on a couple of things. With the inflation, do you think it's lowflation, steady reflation, tempflation, or proper inflation that we're likely to see in the next 12 months as the US economy in particular recovers? And look,
we're going to get a spike higher, certainly in headline inflation. We might see it in some of core inflation, but we'll be back down next year.
Right. Temporary pulse,
you think? Yeah, I have concerns about 10 years down the road, but you know, I'm too old to have big concerns about much longer than that, really. But I mean, you know, the next inflation cycle might, you know, again, we're creating, you know, the things that gave us the disinflation of our careers and the falling bond yields of our careers, they are ending. Mm. True. But that's got nothing to do with the inflationary spike that comes from the world reopening and oil prices going up and that kind of stuff, which we've seen before.
Yeah, yeah. And there's so much slack in the labor market that... and were you surprised with the US, like how low the unemployment rate had to get before we started seeing little hints of inflation during the Trump administration?
Yes, I was. But in that sense, it comes down to this idea that you know, you have to think of global labor as being important. You have to think right the way through the labor market. I think Jay Powell's right. When you get to just this dumb sort of view we used to have about Nehru just doesn't help. Because there's, you know, there's so much technology providing so many goods that are not affected by that. There's so much casual labor that if you want to get an old-fashioned wage-driven inflation cycle, you've got to get wage growth down to, you know, down to the Uber driver, down to the casual laborer. And there's so many people who want those jobs, and there's so many more now, you know.
Yeah.
And they're going to be a huge argument. I don't know how, you know, probably must be the same in Australia. I don't know how many young sort of student age people who would like to be working in anything from a coffee bar to a charity shop to anything else that's shut at the moment will be yapping at the feet of anybody who's allowed to open one of those things when they can. Wages aren't going to go up much at that level. So, you know, I think when we look at it in that sense, right now, you know, we shouldn't be surprised that the way we calculate wage growth, that there's a big drag.
And the
old people going back to work, all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And particularly in Australia, where we have pretty generous welfare provisions. So, for example, farmers find it very, very hard to get farmhands at the moment, even though, you know, unemployment is 6.5%. So other question, what do you think matters for foreign exchange markets more, US real yields or nominal yields?
I think real yields do matter more than they used to. Ever since the Japanese moved to zero rates, you've had way better correlations between dollar yen and real yields than nominal yields or nominal rates. So I think now we're all near zero. The inflation component does matter more than it used to. But you don't want to be an evangelist on it. You know, I play around with this quite a lot in terms of working out. It moves around over time. So you have to, and in a sense, you can turn around and say, you know, if old-fashioned theory in the US is that a fiscal accommodation has a mixed output for a currency because it drives interest rates up and the current account deficit up. But if the interest rates up suck in more money, then the currency strengthens. And then I looked and said, well, that's great. So now I've got anchored low rates and rising longer rates. How do I answer my old textbook question about this theoretical effect on the currency. Ooh, it's a bit of both in it. It's almost as close as I can get.
Can I ask you just one thing, what do you think is different? Like, do you think, you know, in the space of your career, the way central bank inflation targeting has happened and what has happened with fiscal policy in the last decade and then in the last 12 months, what do you think, is there any meaningful shift to how you think, like, growth works at a global level now compared to, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
I think the biggest difference between 30 years ago is how much faster everything moves around the world. I mean, you know, 30 years ago, you could have had SARS in Asia and it wouldn't have got to Europe. We know everything now. It's not just goods. It's money moves faster. It's everything moves faster. We're much more interlinked. And I think that's the, you know, that's the overarching change. The other biggest change in our markets, which is why the real nominal thing matters, is we have taken for granted since 2000 that there is not really any inflation. Inflation's not 2. You know, we worry about some countries that can't keep it above 0. We don't worry about people keeping it under 2.
I remember Ireland in the in the late 90s, and we had very wild inflation, and after the introduction of the euro, and it was pretty scary. I mean, just the way prices would literally go up from one week to the next. You know, you'd go and buy a pint one day, and then it would be cheaper the next Saturday night when you went out. More expensive the next Saturday when you went out. So, pretty scary. So. Sorry, go ahead, Ken.
No, this is just something. It's something actually I've been thinking about a lot over the years, but now that we're talking about it, I've got someone to talk to. The real versus nominal question, I suppose. You think, at least as far as FX is concerned, Ken, do you think it's fair to say that real yields trigger and are catalysts for mean reversions to trend, whereas nominals cause overshoots and directionality in the short term?
Maybe I hadn't thought about it that much, or in that sense. I mean, I'd started off thinking that that you have to find a different way of looking at moves in rates when you're close to zero from the way you saw it when you were at 5%. That was really the biggest difference in my mindset about it. But yes, I mean, it's you could be right.
Okay, fair enough. That was just more intellectual self-gratification than anything else. I'm going to let Colgo wrap it up. Thank you.
Kit Dukes, head of FX strategy and foreign exchange and credit strategy at SocGen. Thank you so much for making the time to come on The VIP Show and chat to us this week.
It was fun. That was fun. I'll invite me again sometime.
Yeah, we would love to. Certainly, maybe the end of this year, maybe we'll revisit this inflation question. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, rate us and leave a review. Wherever you get your podcasts, you can find us on iTunes at The BIP Show. We're on Twitter. It's at @BIP_show. And we're on Facebook too. Just search The BIP Show. We're all there individually at Colgo, at JamesWhelan42, and at Ken Vexler. And Kit Jukes is on there sharing some of his thoughts on a daily basis too. He is well worth a follow. And of course, don't forget to subscribe and rate the show. We love those 5-star ratings. Thanks, everyone. Thank you, James Whelan.
Thank you very much. I will be posting the investable ideas based on today's show on our Facebook page. And that is it. Thank you very much. Great episode. Thank you, Kit.
And thanks, Ken Vexler. Great chatting as always, mate.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you. And thanks, Kit, for coming on. Hopefully next time and sooner rather than later, we can catch up for a pint. Much miss those pints.
Yeah, a really good show, really good chat. Thanks again to Kit Dukes for joining us on The BIP Show. We will catch you next time.